Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have Boston University's 26th Great Debate, sponsored by the College of Communications Department of Journalism. Modeled after the Cambridge and Oxford University Union Society's public discussions, the Great Debate brings together alumni, faculty, and students in a lively but collegial forum to discuss current issues in communication and public affairs. In the tradition of audience-centered parliamentary debate, the Great Debate involves a series of speeches alternating for and against the topic and includes audience participation, as the audience decides the outcome of the debate by voting with their feet and moving to the side of the room representing their decision. Tonight's question, is the American century ending? Introducing our speakers is tonight's moderator, Boston University Journalism Department Chair Robert Zelnick.
In 1940, Henry Luce, the publisher of Time magazine, used the pages of its sister publication, Life magazine, to challenge his countrymen not only to abandon isolationism and to involve themselves more directly in the affairs of nations already at war, but to adopt a long-term approach to international leadership that could mark the start of what he called the American century. With communism and fascism already claiming the allegiance of millions, and the British Empire still an impressive if fading presence, Luce's call may have seemed to many an audacious boast. But with the defeat of Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan on the battlefield, and the later collapse of Soviet communism from internal rot, the U.S. did emerge as the world's premier military and economic power, and Luce could today claim his competence was vindicated, as well as his vision. Now we have a new U.S. president-elect. He inherits a country hungry for change, one which critics say is overcommitted, overextended, and vastly over budget. Is the American century ending, they ask? Yes, many argue, and good riddance. The U.S. global reach, coupled with its propensity to intervene, has come to exceed its legitimate interests. The U.S. must redefine commitments, its interventionist mentality, or they will be redefined for us, for the U.S., by those who bear it no goodwill. Let the U.S. share the globe amicably with the likes of Europe, China, Russia, Japan, and the leading Islamic states. History abhors a vacuum, respond the descendants of Luce. A world without U.S. primacy will soon become prey for those who would proliferate the nuclear threat, support international terrorism, and pursue their own quest for power. Let me now introduce you to the people who will be arguing these matters far more knowledgeably and eloquently than myself. Arguing in the affirmative, that is, that the U.S. century is ending, are Robert S. Litvak, Director of International Security Studies at the Woodrow Wilson Center, International Center for Scholars. And the student debater on the affirmative side is Sarah Thomas, a student in the BU College of Communication. Arguing in the negative, that is, the U.S. century is not ending, a Robert J. Lieber, Professor of Government and International Affairs at Georgetown University. And the student debater in the negative is Andrew Jones, a student in the College of Communication. The order of presentation is as follows. The lead debater on the positive side will speak for 15 minutes. He will be followed by the lead debater on the negative side. Then each student debater, beginning with the positive side, will speak for 7 minutes. Then each side will make a closing argument, beginning with the negative side. Then I am going to ask the audience to divide. If you agree with the affirmative side, you will go to my right, your left. If you agree to the negative side, you'll go to my left, your right. And I will decide on the basis of the division of the House who is the winner of tonight's debate. And we'll start with the affirmative side, and that is Mr. Litvak.
Good evening. Thank you for having me. To understand why the American century is ending, one must understand what the American century was. As we've heard, the term was famously coined by Time magazine publisher Henry Luce to exhort the United States to enter World War II. America emerged from that war a colossus. the world's other industrial powers, Europe, Soviet Russia, China, and Japan, all lay shattered. In 1945, the United States accounted for about one-half of the world's entire economic output, and it had a monopoly on the absolute weapon, the atom bomb. From that paramount position, America could have imposed its will on these weakened states. Instead, Washington exercised strategic restraint. The Truman administration moved to realize Roosevelt's vision. It spearheaded a period of extraordinary institution building. In so doing, it created a post-war system unlike any other in history. This new international order had a Made in America stamp on it. Its foundation was security and economic institutions such as NATO and the World Bank. In the aftermath of World War II, as the Cold War with the Soviet Union threatened, the Europeans looked to America for security and economic assistance. These states willingly joined the multilateral institutions forged through American leadership. It was a consensual union that led to the creation of unprecedented wealth and security in North America, Western Europe, and Japan. The Western community stood in sharp contrast to the Soviet bloc, which could only be held together through the coercive presence of the Red Army. The hallmark of the American century was the embedding of U.S. power in international institutions. That was the key to American success. It explains the riddle of the 1990s. When the Cold War ended and the Soviet Union dissolved, the United States was the sole remaining superpower. The term hyperpower entered our political lexicon. With defense spending exceeding that of the other major powers combined, political scientists described the world as unipolar. So why didn't a coalition of states arise in the 1990s to balance American power? If you're a proponent of the realist school of international relations, which holds that peace arises from a stable distribution of power among states, that's what you would have predicted. Political scientist John Eikenberry has persuasively argued that the reason why a counter-coalition against American hyperpower did not emerge was this embedding of U.S. power in international security and economic institutions. That channeling of American power made it more legitimate and less threatening to other states. It fostered the perception of the United States as a benign superpower and at the same time advanced American national interests. Conservative columnist Charles Krauthammer proposed a bold alternative to this approach in a famous foreign affairs article published just after the Cold War ended and a hot war in the Persian Gulf loomed to reverse Saddam Hussein's occupation of Kuwait. Krauthammer urged then-President George H.W. Bush to seize what he termed the unipolar moment and advocated that the United States, quote, unashamedly lay down the rules of world order and be prepared to enforce them, close quote. Neither Bush nor Clinton took up that call. The grand strategy for the post-Cold War era that both Bush and Clinton pursued could be reduced to one word, integration. The goal was to fully integrate Russia, China, and the former Soviet bloc states into the international order that America had played the seminal role in forging after World War II. The Clinton administration's guiding principle was that the United States would act multilaterally when possible, but unilaterally when necessary. The big change came after 9/11, when the United States departed from what had been its formula for success in the era after World War II. The terrorist attacks on September 11, 2001 exposed the susceptibility of the United States and other Western societies to non-state terrorism. But those attacks, however horrific and psychologically searing, did not alter the structure of international relations. In the eyes of the international community, the U.S. military intervention in Afghanistan and against al-Qaeda and the Taliban regime that had abetted the 9/11 attacks was a war of necessity, a legitimate and proportionate application of the inherent right of self-defense codified in the U.N. Charter. But that international solidarity with the United States collapsed when the Bush administration pressed to extend its global war on terrorism into Iraq. At the heart of the rancorous U.N. debate over Iraq was the cardinal principle of state sovereignty. In the first Gulf War, Security Council authorization and the forging of a broad multinational coalition to liberate Kuwait were diplomatically possible because Saddam Hussein had violated the universally supported international norm against external aggression. Or as one commentator baldly put it, one state should not be permitted to murder another state. By contrast, in the bitter 2003 UN debate, the attainment of Security Council approval for military action in Iraq was bound to rouse strong opposition rooted in the same international norm. Compelling Iraqi WMD disarmament through an externally imposed regime change would be a precedent-setting negation of state sovereignty, that enforcement of the Security Council resolutions required the overthrowing of the Saddam Hussein regime. The UN Security Council crisis leading up to the 2003 Iraq War began as a debate about Iraq and Saddam Hussein, but it turned into a referendum on the United States and the legitimate exercise of American power. President George W. Bush asserted that he did not need the permission of the UN Security Council to defend America. Historian John Lewis Gaddis concluded, quote, "The rush to war in Iraq in the absence of a first shot or smoking gun left a growing sense throughout the world that there could be nothing worse than American hegemony if it was to be used in this way," close quote. The United States was viewed as a rogue superpower that had arrogantly asserted a unilateral right of preventive military action. This perception unleashed a diplomatic effort by France, Germany, and Russia to block the use of force against Iraq by withholding the legitimizing imprimatur of the United Nations. 5 years after 9/11, a plurality of West Europeans, according to a public opinion poll, judged the United States to be, quote, "the greatest threat to global stability," close quote. This changed perception of the United States from victim to rogue superpower was the result of Washington's sharp departure from its past policies and the rise of a new assertive unilateralism. But the United States has paid a high price for essentially going it alone in Iraq. Whereas the 1991 Gulf War essentially paid for itself with large subventions by the Saudis and the Japanese, the price tag for the Iraq War may reach $1 trillion. The United States has learned the hard lesson of the utility of multilateralism in conferring political legitimacy and the tangible assistance of allies. In dealing with Iran and North Korea, the other two members of his axis of evil, Bush has moved toward greater multilateralism. But his second administration has been hostage to the legacy of the first. It continues to send out a mixed message on whether the U.S. objective is to change the regimes in Iran and North Korea or to change their behavior. In the current nuclear showdown with Iran, President Bush's mantra is, "all options are on the table," a clear reference to the possibility of military action. But to what end? What is the objective? Regime change or behavior change? Keeping regime change on the table in Washington has meant that behavior change has been off the table in Tehran. And again, because of the cardinal principle of state sovereignty, the perception that the U.S. objective is to change the regime in Iran makes it more difficult to get international support from key countries like Russia for meaningful economic sanctions if Iran continues to defy non-proliferation norms. President-elect Obama is being dealt a tough hand. He's inheriting two wars, one going better, the other worse, deficits that have doubled the national debt in 8 years, and a global financial crisis. The human rights abuses at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo have stripped America of its moral authority. So what should be done? The new president should return to our winning formula, the embedding of American power in international institutions. That was the key to America's success after World War II. That channeling of American power, as I've argued, made it legitimate and non-threatening to other states. Over the last 8 years, the Bush administration has deviated from that winning formula to our national detriment. Historically, the periods of greatest turmoil in the modern era have arisen from the emergence of expansionist great powers with unbounded ambition, such as Nazi Germany or Stalin's Soviet Union, seeking the wholesale transformation of the international order. With the demise of the Soviet Union, the defining feature of contemporary international relations has been the absence of competition among the great powers that might bring with it the risk of major war. Some commentators declared that Russia's military intervention in Georgia in August 2008 marked the return of the Cold War. What we are witnessing instead is the renationalization of Russian foreign policy. Though a State Department official called Russia a revisionist state after its move last August, its revisionism is in the conventional tradition of a great power seeking to create a sphere of influence on its periphery. This stance is closer to the Monroe Doctrine than to the Comintern. To be sure, Russia's new assertiveness carries risks of regional strife and inadvertent military escalation. But the key point in this context is that, unlike its behavior during the Cold War, the Kremlin is not advancing an alternative vision of international order. To be sure, we could mismanage our way into crises with Russia and China. But that prospect is not inevitable, precisely because both of these great powers have a tangible economic interest in integrating into the international system rather than overturning it. Newsweek columnist Fareed Zakaria argues that we are entering a post-American world, while Council on Foreign Relations President Richard Haass has declared that the era of American dominance is over and will be followed by the age of nonpolarity. Haass defines nonpolarity as an international system comprised of numerous centers with meaningful power. Across the various hierarchies of power other than military, financial, industrial, social, cultural, the world is increasingly multipolar. The other team will no doubt argue that we on the affirmative side are declinists, America's in decline, and that many predictions of American decline, such as historian Paul Kennedy's bestseller from the 1980s, have been proven wrong and will be proved wrong again. We are not arguing that America is in decline, but rather that the distribution of power in the international system is shifting. What that distribution will be is difficult to predict. The bottom line, though, is that no single country will have such a profound role in shaping the next era in international relations as the United States did during the American century. The United States will remain the world's leading power. No major issue in international relations can be decided without American participation and acceptance, but America's ability to control outcomes, which is the political science definition of power, will be limited. To characterize the 21st century as we characterize the 20th, that is, it is again an American century, simply does not accord with the evidence of the changes unfolding before us. Thank you very much.
Addressing the negative side, the lead debater is Mr. Robert Lieber.
Is the American century ending? Certainly not. Scarcely a day goes by without yet another book, an article, a speaker, report, or a debater telling you that America is in trouble, either at home or abroad, or both. These admonitions extend not only to economic, diplomatic, and geopolitical realms, but even to the cultural realm. Now, the United States certainly does face real and sometimes serious problems, as it does now with a very severe financial crisis. Nonetheless, there is an unmistakable echo of the past in the arguments we hear so often today. Let me say that antecedents or precursors of these views were evident in the 1970s and again in the 1980s and even on occasion in the 1990s, and on occasion even in identical language. In fact, various kinds of declinist arguments and proclamations have appeared on and off not only throughout the 20th century, but also during the 18th and 19th centuries. The fact is that it can be constructive to compare these arguments and the prescriptions of both current and past declinists together. The evidence, I submit, is of a pattern of overreaction, ahistoricism, and lack of appreciation for the robustness and staying power of the United States. In short, there are two propositions that make up this argument about the end of the American century. First, that the United States as a society, an economy, and a political power is itself in some form of decline, although my friend Rob Litwack denies that, I think it is essential to the argument of the declinists. The second proposition is that America's world role is also in decline as a result not only of American weakness, but the rise of other countries, and that counterbalancing against American power is taking place, as well as the loss of American legitimacy. I submit to you both of these propositions are false. First, a brief sampling of some of the propositions, and they come from various points on the political compass. Fareed Zakaria, in a best-selling book, has written that America is, quote, an enfeebled superpower. He also points to the fact that the world's largest Ferris wheel is no longer in the U.S., but I think he says in Singapore. President Ahmadinejad of Iran has said at the United Nations this autumn that the American empire is reaching the end of its road. And the German finance minister, Peer Steinbrück, said with the outbreak of the economic crisis that, quote, the U.S. will lose its status as the superpower of the world financial system. 2008 is a fundamental rupture. Well, let me suggest to you that all those speakers are wrong. For one thing, there's nothing new in the United States facing troubles or problems at home and abroad. We have often done so throughout our history. We face them now, and I dare say we shall face them in the future. Indeed, it's instructive to do a little bit of looking back through history. In the 18th century, you had French intellectuals writing about the United States, both pre- and post-independence, in ways that were contemptuous of what America was all about. A prominent French figure, for instance, wrote that America was so weak that its dogs did not bark, its birds did not sing, its people were less strong and less intelligent. In the subsequent periods during the Revolution, Jacobins, and later in the Napoleonic period, there was a comparable contempt for what America was all about. In the 19th century, especially on the right in Europe, aristocrats and anti-modernists ridiculed America's bourgeois society and its lack, they thought, of high culture. Similar arguments could be heard from the right in the earlier part of the 20th century. In the 1930s, American democracy and economy were ridiculed and condemned both from the extreme right and from the left by advocates of fascism and by advocates of Soviet communism, both domestic and foreign. In the late 1950s, with the Soviet launch of Sputnik, it was said that America was falling behind in the space race and in every other respect to the Soviets. In the 1970s, there were reversals in Vietnam, the oil shocks, a very severe recession, inflation, and unemployment, the fall of the Shah, the Soviet inroads in Afghanistan, Angola, Nicaragua, the Carter-Meles speech, and so forth. And in 1987, Paul Kennedy got rich with a book about imperial overstretch and the implication that America was about to recapitulate the cycle of rise and now decline that Britain had gone through. Only the Brits had done it over the course of a couple of centuries, and the U.S. would do it in a fraction of the time. The declinist arguments, in short, rest on a series of pieces about power, an argument that with the rise of other countries, there are permanent shifts in the distribution of power internationally that represent a profound change, and that other countries are either actively balancing against America or else engaging in what has been called soft balancing. In the military realm, it is said that the military is overstretched, or, as Paul Kennedy put it, that America suffers from imperial overstretch or imperial overreach. In the economic realm, the rise of China is cited, globalization and its impacts, oil prices and America's oil dependence, the problems of paying for our entitlement programs, our deficits in the budget and trade, and now, of course, in spades, the financial crisis. Then there is the legitimacy argument, which Rob has just made, about the impact of Iraq and the policies of the Bush administration. And finally, the fact that we have the supposed fact that we have an aging population, which will further undercut our role, is cited. However, there are powerful counterarguments to each of these. I can only touch on them briefly, but I think the counterarguments are impressive. First, economically, with the exception of the period right after World War II, when the rest of the world was prostrate, the fact is that for about the last four decades or so, America's share of the world economy, world gross product, for instance, is about the same. 21% of world GDP is what we have now. It's not very different from what it was three or four decades ago. 21% of world manufacturing is what we have now and had in 1975. Yes, we're in a severe crisis, but it's not only is it manageable, but the extraordinary costs of the United States managing that crisis are a lot less in relative terms than the Europeans or the Japanese, for instance, are forced to spend right now. About America's economy, particularly the bemoaning of our lack of competitiveness, the problems of our educational system, and the rest of it, a little data won't hurt, evidence. The World Economic Forum, for the third year in a row, has classed the United States number one in global competitiveness. You can look it up on the web or in the back pages of the issues of The Economist magazine. Technology and innovation, information technology, those rankings repeatedly put the United States as either first in the world or perhaps second or third in competition with Singapore and Finland, not exactly great power threats. America's universities are tops. 17 of the world's 20 top research universities are in the United States. 70% of Nobel Prize winners work in the United States. Even demography continues to work in America's favor. The U.S. has the world's third largest population. Other countries, other great power competitors, are aging much faster. Russia is losing 700,000 people a year. Europe and Japan have declining birth rates. Even China, with its one-child policy, is facing a more severe demographic shift than we do in terms of having fewer people in the workforce to support a rapidly aging population as they move toward retirement. The American birth rate, at a fertility rate of 2.1, is at the replacement rate. And when you add in immigration, and the U.S. still remains hugely attractive to the world, America's population is increasing, not decreasing, and its share of the population, which is active and vigorous, will continue to be substantial. In terms of the military, it's true the military is stretched, but I reject the notion that it's overstretched. We spend, to support that military, even with two wars, just 4.5% of our gross domestic product on defense. That sounds like a lot, but it is a lot less than in the past. During the height of the Reagan buildup in the 80s, the figure was 6.5%. In 1968, it was over 9%. In 1953, it was 14%. Our military technology, our power projection capacity remain unique. And finally, there is the American flexibility, adaptiveness, openness, and ability to respond to crisis. Equally wrong, the first proposition about American decline, the second proposition is wrong about the world balancing against the United States. You can't beat somebody with nobody. There is no other real peer competitor for the United States, not the Europeans individually, collectively, not Japan, not India, which has leaned toward the United States rather than away from it. Indeed, the European countries, the Asians, and even many of the Middle Eastern countries embrace the United States, lean toward it, or bandwagon with it instead of balancing against it, in part because of what the U.S. represents, in part to offset threats to themselves regionally. Let me conclude. There are lots of serious challenges to the United States, but we will surmount them. We will surmount the present crisis, and efforts to deal with it will actively involve the United States. But the U.S. will retain the world's largest economy, third largest population, international leadership in technology and competitiveness, the world's leading universities, the most capable armed forces, and will continue to exhibit a remarkable degree of political and economic freedom, openness, dynamism, and adaptability that continues to attract the world. In sum, neither the rise of regional powers nor competition in a globalized world nor imperial overstretch or domestic weakness have the transformative effects the new declinists postulate. The U.S. will not lose its position of predominance anytime soon. Over the years, America has been underestimated from the 18th century to the present, and declinist forecasts in previous eras have been wrong. The current crop of declinist authors are wrong, too. The 21st century remains the American century. Thank you for listening.
Professor Lieber. Now, from the affirmative side, we have our student debater, Sarah Thomas.
Good evening, and I would like to thank Professor Zelnick for moderating. Is the American century ending? It's not a question that often stands starkly on its own. Rather, it usually comes bundled with a great deal of paranoid baggage. If not ours, whose century is it? Is our way of life in danger? Are we doomed? What's your political affiliation? Why do you hate America? These ancillary questions are specious, but that doesn't mean the formulation of the original question isn't problematic. What does it mean to own a century? If our century is ending, what characterized its duration? Who heralded it? And who will conduct its autopsy? Most importantly, what happens next? The phrase American century first entered the national rhetoric after a magazine cover article in 1941. Henry Luce envisioned for America a position of authority and missionary zeal that would bring freedom to the darkest corners of the world and prosperity to the American people. This, keep in mind, just after the Great Depression, before World War II, and the sweeping changes in the political and social fabric of America it occasioned. Yet, there was no doubt Luce was prescient. As we have heard, for a time, the American way of being was the envy and desire of the rest of the world. Yet that way of being is no more a reality today in Kansas than it is in Kenya. It is doubtful the people who needed a Pearl Harbor-sized dose of persuasion to engage in battle some of the most evil regimes the world has ever known would understand preemptive war. Doubtful a generation who had never heard of Diners Club and remembered soup lines would choose to gamble with the trade deficit in the trillions while spending more than they earned. They built infrastructural superhighways without imagining the technological equivalent. They fought the cancer of global communism and suffered the autoimmune disease of the McCarthyist witch hunts. They held candles in Haight Ashbury and truncheons along Highway 80. If that is the American century Luce envisioned, it was over before nearly all the students at this university were born. A casualty of the inexorable forces of progress, which along with debt and uncertainty, have brought us civil rights, intellectual freedom, and cultural pluralism unmatched elsewhere in human history. But need we trade in an American century for these material and cultural gains? It would take an intellect more perspicacious than mine far longer than 7 minutes to answer that fully. But part of the answer is surely found in our original question, is the American century ending? Which reveals something very interesting about we asking it. Along with stubborn litigiousness and a preference for coffee over tea, one thing which has always characterized America is our easy millennialism. From John Winthrop's City on a Hill to the Age of Aquarius to the panic over the Y2K bug, Americans remain peculiarly convinced they are living at the twilight of civilization. Indeed, might be uniquely complicit in it. This trend persists today and plays out in matters both as banal as a pop culture fascination with apocalypses in which American society is destroyed by an implacable horde, and as baroque as the global war on terror, in which a few dozen terrorists touched off a conflict which has to date claimed hundreds of thousands of lives and eroded the liberty of every single person in America. From the perspective of a demagogue, millennialism is a highly useful attitude to cultivate in an electorate. It is easy to convince people that their eschatological panic can be alleviated if only an ambiguous and shadowy course of action is undertaken. It is easy to enforce an agenda, however nefarious, if only you can make people believe that their century, their freedom, is at stake. It is an unfortunate truism that some will always prefer an unsatisfactory present over an uncertain future. The American century of Henry Luce isn't in jeopardy. That American century is dead as Jim Crow and the snap-brim fedora. As with any dead thing, it is time to admit that the health risks that attend leaving it unburied far outweigh the hollow benefits gained by pretending it is still viable. The current collapse of the world financial markets alone demonstrates that, clearly as a cholera epidemic. It is only by facing this hard truth that Americans can claim a position of moral and cultural ascendancy appropriate for a world far more complex than any Luce envisioned. It is only by discarding the rhetoric of the American century, only ever in the final analysis words on a page, intended to fill the cover of a newsstand magazine, that America can truly begin, has begun, looking forward. It will not be easy. We are living, to put it mildly, in interesting times. The students attending this university will graduate, sooner or later, and when they do, they will find that a large part of their environmental, financial, political, and international legacy has been mortgaged. They will inherit toys painted with lead and food tainted with melamine, heavy metals in their water and bum mutual funds in their markets. They will be attempting to negotiate a minefield of political and religious intrigues abroad, just as the moment when our credibility on the world stage is at its most shaky. But if I might be permitted to speak on behalf of that generation, I would like to say, okay, we will play the hand we were dealt, and certainly other generations have played worse. The generation of the American century saw a man die for having a dream. In our generation, 180 million of us helped another man achieve it. And I feel confident that the old narratives, simple and satisfying and filled with white hats and black capes and Horatio Alger-style pat endings, simply aren't going to cut it any longer. As a very wise man once said, when the going gets weird, the weird turn pro. It is time. We will turn pro. We have gotten serious. We will put aside as a childish thing this romantic, self-serving language of end times and American centuries. We will select leaders who will develop cogent, nuanced solutions to our problems. We will take responsibility for our plans and acknowledge our mistakes. We will think less in terms of our destiny and more in terms of our capabilities, both as individuals and as a nation. We will, in short, take America's place, one that will, no doubt, be central, but certainly not unilateral, in the ambiguous, weird, fascinating, fast, scary, perplexing, and potentially glorious world century that is already upon us. Thank you.
And now the only student at Boston University licensed to call me Bobby Z.
Andrew. Good evening, I'm Andrew Jones. Yes, the United States of America has taken a major hit in the last decade, the first of the 21st century. Anyone not willing to acknowledge that is living in a state of denial where Prozac may not be sufficient enough of a remedy to get out of it. You don't have to be affiliated with any political party or be a representative of stringent ideologies personal to oneself to see from a fully rational standpoint that America's standing around the world isn't at the same optimum level as it was in the closing stages of the preceding decade. Two exhausting wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, with the latter being heavily perceived as an ill-advised jaunt domestically and abound. The recent global economic crisis, where even those not well-versed in the field of economics are cognizant of the fact of Wall Street shuffles playing a major role in it, and the growing sense of hypocrisy and petulance from a multitude of Earth's other lands over the behavior and actions of this nation, would have people to agree, if humbled and rational, that America is not having one of its proudest times at the moment. A failure to acknowledge, as I stated at the not-too-distant beginning, is a display of out-of-touch thinking with reality. And that is putting a myriad of salad dressing on a reality, on a really, really dry salad, to say the least. But with that being said, despite all those problems, despite all those humiliating episodes still playing out, despite all those other missteps in between, albeit torture in Guantanamo Bay or being unable to really pose a significant threat to the calamities taking part still in countries such as the Sudan and Burma at the moment, the fact that the question of whether America's century of preeminence is over is being asked leads to a question asked of itself. If preeminence was truly over, then the question in contention at this very moment, in this very building, would not even be interrogated of us at the moment. The fact that this question is raised shows that America is still the preeminent power in the world without a question. Because if it was no longer the premier force, then the facts would be so categorical and convincing that an argument would not necessarily be absurd, but would be a waste of time. Now, the definition of preeminence does not mean total comprehensive domination. Preeminence entry in most lexicons does not include perfect in all areas, or infallible, or consistently fortuitous. Preeminence's actual definition is better than all others. Though it would be hard to defend that the sound of that phrase doesn't breathe even the slightest bit of arrogance or even cockiness, for I believe all are equal, and that one human being, no matter his or her status, is not better than his or her fellow human being. That in regards to countries, that the United States situation, even with its backward steps of late, is in a position that every country in this world would trade for its own. Whether it is a fledgling country like Montenegro or a still prominent figure like Britain, the United States has the upper hand by a considerable margin in key areas such as its growth domestic product, its military, its educational institutions, and its unrivaled diversity. As CNN and Newsweek's Fareed Zakaria noted in his essay in June's issue of Foreign Affairs, despite an administration whose tenure has led to the highest unemployment rate this country has ever known, under the Bush cabinet, the United States is still accounting for roughly a quarter of the world output, with a still impressive 26% last year. And though that number is likely to decline in the next score, most predictions stated that the United States will still be twice the size of China in terms of nominal GDP. Despite the news of falling behind in international test scores to India and China, the U.S. still boasts 8 or 9 of the world's 10 premier institutions, along with at least half of the world's top 50 educational facilities, maybe even BU as well. Despite the poor handling of both Baghdad and Kabul, the United States military is still a unit that is second or third to none. Though through its Army, Navy, Marines, Air Force, and other divisions, the United States is still considered dominant in every level of the military field. Land, sea, airspace, any element you can think of, the United States is steadfast in being in pole position in this area, and it spends more than the next 14 countries combined in military spending, accounting for almost 50% of global research spending. These facts could be used to dub anyone willing to openly question whether a president, whoever he or she is, will be possibly afraid of meeting an unfavorable and possible anti-ally and enemy leader of another country, as one looking at the full context of how powerful the U.S. military still is not applicable. The same could equally, if not more, be said of the diversity of this country. The United States has changed history in its ability to handle a melting pot of different races, religions, and elements of life without having utterly disastrous terminal ending of the nation as a whole conflicts. America has successfully integrated race after race after race into its mainstream, as Zakaria said. The bestseller and provocative journalist added, "This is what sets the country apart from past great economical powers that have grown fat and lazy and slipped behind as they face the rise of leaner, hungrier nations." It would be amiss to not mention, however, that despite all of these arguments, the September and still economical crisis that plagued America and the rest of the world's most prominent businesses and stock market domiciles did some damage to the argument of further of Americans' preeminence. Up-to-date reports of European markets, Asian markets, and even the Australian markets in a state of crisis were all tied into what happened on the stock exchange in New York during that time. And it was still looked at as a day as American capitalism in an earthquake with how it looked so shaky. But even so, despite the crisis, there was a silver lining for the argument of American supremacy, that despite that unfortunate circumstances, that the power of the United States, even inadvertently, was yielded on the rest of that world that day and in that crisis still happening right now. Even the critic Vladimir Putin of American policies inadvertently displayed America's elite status. The Russian prime minister said, "Everything happening now in the economic and financial sphere began in the United States. This is not irresponsible of specific individuals, but the irresponsibility of the system that claims leadership." And that leadership is another vital factor displaying how the American century, despite pitfalls, is still continuing thanks to the world's attention regarding not only this presidential election, but in others. With the world watching so closely, would preeminence still exist if it wasn't watching? Yes, to conclude, only the irrational or the delusional would state that America's standing in the world is at the level of what it was, when Y2K was a slogan for those to go crazy. Those problems that have beckoned towards America stem from its own follies and awkward faults. And the rest of the world, though far from buttery smooth, has indeed played a part in closing the gap of American supremacy and power. But with a new administration led by future 44th President Barack Obama, practically vying and striving for American supremacy to not be questioned like it is tonight, in an irrational way that it is, there's one thing I can say about that gap closing. It is still a gap, and that gap still exists. Thank you.
Thank you. It's always been a source of pride to us how well our student debaters perform on the same stage as some of the most preeminent scholars in the field. Now we shall go to the closing statements and arguments, and we start with the negative side and conclude with the positive. Mr. Lieber.
Thank you, Professor Zelnick. Yes, we can. Does it have an echo? It should. Barack Obama is committed to the United States playing a leading world role. He wants to do it better than his predecessor. In short, he's in a line of previous American presidents. The Clinton administration, President Clinton and Secretary Albright, correctly referred to the United States as the indispensable nation. Why is that the case? Well, it's because in facing the world's most urgent, deadly, life-and-death problems, the alternative to the United States not playing an important role is not that the UN or somebody else will do it, not the EU, not another country, but that more often than not, nobody will. The evidence of that can be summed up in several words. Rwanda, Bosnia, Darfur. We live in a world of real threats, and contrary to what those in the affirmative have said to you, the threats are not due merely to a response to what America does. In other words, the radical Islamists, the Russians, they take the positions they do for their own reasons. Then you have the weakness of international institutions in the UN and the EU. That's not a good thing, but it's a fact. And finally, you have the unique U.S. role. And by the way, taking this kind of world role, whether advocated by the Clinton administration or previous ones, aspects of the Bush administration, or the objectives and aims and ideals of the incoming Obama administration, is not just a matter of protecting and promoting America's own national interests and security, but also, if you value a world which is less dangerous, more secure, more stable, less violent, then it needs to be a world in which the U.S. plays an active, engaged role as a leader, as part of the American century. Without it, it will be a much more nasty, violent, dangerous place, not just for us, but for everybody else.
A few points, all of them tangential. Precursors to views do not invalidate them. It is more noble to sit with friends than to command underlings. Only apologists for Florentine autocrats in the 16th century divide leadership into love and fear. The true essence of leadership is and has always been example and common interest. These always work, and it doesn't matter whose century they take place in. I don't deny a bit of paranoid competitiveness is healthy. That's what makes us win space races. I can't believe that by acknowledging the necessity for pluralism in the international stage, our grandparents would not have gone to the moon. I can believe that trying to pay for three wars during a financial meltdown is what's keeping us off Mars. Claiming things that other countries are worse off is a poor and craven way to defend a nation like America. You can't create a tautology. Asking the question proves that this is still our country, not that this is still our century. No one's denying our greatness. Our affirmative position is less about having a star vehicle than it is about having an ensemble cast. The goal of a superpower should always be to rise up those they lead by example. If the final analysis after the American century is that other countries are not ready or willing to step up to the plate, to take care of Darfur, to take care of Sudan, then that says a little bit more about the American century that's over than it does about the rest of the world. This isn't a judgment. This is a strategy. The proponents of this view always go back to World War II. World War II is the last time when the commitments of our leaders did not outpace the political will of our citizenry. The only war we, by and large, don't feel guilty about. Attempting to prolong the rhetoric of that war and use it to justify and gloss frightened scrambling after manifest destiny is a poor legacy for the greatest generation. Who will take care of the world? This think of the children tone ends up condescending the world. The answer is, we all will.
Thank you very much for an excellent exchange of ideas and viewpoints. Let me ask you to do one final thing for us, and that is, those of you who felt that the affirmative side of the question, yes, the U.S. century is ending or the American century is ending, line up on that's this side of the room to my right. Those of you who believe the negative side prevailed, that the American century is not ending, indicate this by gathering to the left. And I will proclaim a victor and see you all at the next great debate. I am going to declare the affirmative side of the issue the victor of this debate on the basis of the audience numbers. Thank you very much, panelists. Thank you, audience. Good luck.
This is WBUR. You've been listening to Boston University's 26th Great Debate, sponsored by the College of Communications Department of Journalism. Tonight's question was, is the American century ending? Arguing in the affirmative was Robert Litvak, Director of International Security Studies at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and student debater Sarah Thomas from the College of Communication. Arguing in the negative was Robert J. Lieber, Professor of Government and International Affairs at Georgetown University, and student debater Andrew Jones, also from the College of Communication. Tonight's moderator was Boston University Journalism Department Chairman Robert Zelnick. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Jared Mooney. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.